Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. The longest shutdown in U.S. history comes to an end with surprising ramifications for Wisconsin's hemp industry. Plus, President Donald Trump issues federal pardons for the lawyers charged with developing the 2020 false electors plot from Wisconsin. And report cards grading Wisconsin schools found that most are meeting or exceeding expectations. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for November 14th. I'm Ani Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome to Rewind. Big week. The longest shutdown in American history is over, and lots to talk about there. So let's just focus first on the end of the shutdown, kind of exactly what happened. So Senate passed a bill on Monday, House passed it on Wednesday, the president signed it later that night. Wisconsin's congressional delegation sort of broke down along party lines, as we might expect. There was some Democratic support in the country for these bills, but not out of Wisconsin. This will keep the government funded through January 30th. Most of the government. And of course, there are some consequences. So Democrats did not get what they wanted on the ACA tax credits. But what the deal does is it blocks mass layoffs of federal workers, increased funding for WIC, increased funding for military construction, and then sort of the big story that we've been talking about for a couple of weeks was what was happening with SNAP. It's going to fully cover SNAP and then reimburse states that were covering it. So that's sort of the food share update here in Wisconsin. But really big news, longest shutdown in history.
And what did we get out of it? And is going to happen in January. So you go back, rewind a week ago, we were talking about how Democrats had this great night last Tuesday of the elections. All this like sugar high off of like how well they did New Jersey and Virginia and other places. Now we're back to Democrats infighting constantly, talking about you guys caved. What do we get out of this? What are we doing here? So I've been asking people, is this going to last, right? Because we have an election next fall that they need the base to be energized. I get the consensus is this is probably temporary, back to the infighting thing Democrats have been doing. The phrase Democrats in disarray is pretty popular in the national media, I believe. So it probably goes away after a while, unless we into a cycle of shutdown, shutdown, shutdown. So January comes, do they shut it down again? If they do, for how long? Is it a six-month extension then, a year? Like what happens? So there's possibilities out there, but kind of politically looking at this as Republicans are going, it's not about us getting our butts kicked last week anymore. It's their problem right now. Although at the same time, looking at polling, it's not clear there's a loser either side. So people kind of blame Republicans a little bit more because they control everything. Democrats a bit, and then some people blame everybody because they think they all stink.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think Republicans have been at least sort of in my inbox, like claiming victory in the same way that after the election last week, Democrats were claiming kind of universal victory. So again, that kind of war of words. One really surprising consequence of the shutdown deal that I certainly didn't see coming was a change to the federal farm bill and the definition of hemp. And so, you know, one of the things that I often talk about with people is the fact that marijuana is illegal in Wisconsin, and you would be forgiven for not knowing that, walking down certain streets in Wisconsin where there are these Delta 9 shops and vape shops and things like this. That's all because of this federal loophole in the Farm Bill from 2018 that allowed for hemp-derived products to kind of start hitting the shelves. And so there is now this provision in the shutdown deal that says, that redefines hemp. Essentially, it would affect something like 95% of hemp-derived businesses because of just the way that it rewrites what hemp is. That'll go into effect in a year. So I've been speaking with all of these producers of, you know, THC beverages and CBD gummies kind of here in Wisconsin who are, to use their words, really kind of freaking out about what this means for their industry. But it's been this really interesting look at this kind of unregulated industry that's really cropped up in Wisconsin, even without having legal recreational or medicinal marijuana.
So I remember in Wisconsin, we passed the same farm bill essentially here in the state. And during the discussion back in the late 2010s, is about paper and clothing and like how it's a great crop for farmers. What I found out in my own reporting is like there was a breakthrough technology-wise in terms of like getting feel-good things out of hemp, I guess I'll put it that way, after that farm bill became law. And so now you've seen this explosion of products. there are more questions than answers right now. So one, will Congress stick to its guns on this and we're not going to have anything change between now and a year from now? Okay, number one. Number two, if that does happen, what's that mean for Wisconsin? We both reported that it would impact all these products if the feds want to go in and start like breaking things up. My point about that is, so let's look at cigarettes. Right now, federal law says you'd be 21 to buy cigarettes. It's 18 in Wisconsin. You can still buy cigarettes at 19 and 20 years old, despite federal law, because you know why? There aren't federal agents going to gas stations saying, "Are you? Let me see your ID." So likewise, I've been asked the question, what happens if the feds stick with this ban, but Wisconsin has a loophole in the books? Then what? Well, are you going to see the FBI go to Woodman's on Saturday and take out all the THC drinks? I don't think so. Are you going to see, it also depends on what the governor or wants, right? Are they going to have DOR go in and try? But then again, can DOR enforce federal law? See, more questions than answers about what's going to happen. So will we still have THC drinks a year and a half from now in Wisconsin?
Yeah, one of the lawyers that I spoke to said essentially what you're saying, that the DEA does not have the manpower or the will to go into, you know, these little kind of cannabis producers here in Wisconsin and try to break them up. But what he did say could happen is changes to sort of the regulatory framework, such as it exists or such as it doesn't exist currently. So people's taxes and kind of financial opportunities might shift. And so that could be, you know, challenging for some of these small producers. I've also spoken with public health officials who essentially said they have no sympathy for these businesses that cropped up in the absence of a regulatory framework and just sort of hoped that they could kind of keep skirting by. But it does kind of sound like, you know, there is a lot of panic and alarm in the industry. It does sound like they might be able to kind of keep skating by because this is, it just kind of creates a bit of a mess. It was a loophole and now it's a mess.
Now, speaking of regulation, there are bills going through the legislature right now that would try to bring some order to this industry. So we have a three-tiered system for alcohol in Wisconsin. You can't be a manufacturer, a retailer, and a distributor. You have to have like these buffers. It was basically was created 100 some years ago to try and break up monopolies in alcohol. They now want some Republicans to apply that model to these producers. The problem is, they argue, the producers, we do direct-to-customer shipments. Like, we would really get hammered hard by this. We don't. Yes, we want regulations. We want to have like an age limit. You got to be 21 or whatever to get it. We don't want, though, to have to give our product to an alcohol distributor to go out there and put it in stores. So I'm watching that kind of bill play out. It was in a committee this week, passed on party lines. Would the governor sign it? Got to his desk. Will he get through both houses? There are lots of questions there. So there's another question mark for the industry about what might happen to state regulations for them going forward.
And, you know, one other question that I have is, in other states that have either medicinal or recreational or both forms of marijuana, potentially those sort of hemp industry folks have a pivot point. Here in Wisconsin, there's not that pivot point. So does this create more of an appetite among the public and among lawmakers to come to some sort of solution about marijuana distribution? So lots to pay attention to there. Who knew that this would be the kind of the big story coming out of the shutdown deal? Another big thing on our radars this week was school report cards. So that is report cards grading the schools and the school district. And so this is a federally mandated kind of annual process. But the criteria by which the schools are graded and the districts are graded shifted a little bit this summer. So this came out this week, and it found that the vast, vast majority of school districts are met, exceeded, or significantly exceeded expectations. 85% of public schools, 85% of school choice private schools, 70 public schools failed to meet expectations entirely, and then more than half of school choice private schools were not ranked due to insufficient data. So if 94% of school districts are meeting or exceeding expectations, what did these report cards actually kind of tell us?
So let me know if you've heard this before. These ratings are useless because they've changed the basis for the foundation for them, or these are better reflections of what's happening in our schools. Have you heard that before?
I've heard that one a couple of times.
One from the Department of Public Instruction, one from conservatives in education. So I don't know what to make of these report cards because, again, there isn't an easy apples-to-apples comparison of this year versus the past 10 years to know what's going on. The foundation's changed. So we're left kind of trying to guess what this means and if really schools are really doing better or if it's just they're getting on a curve in a different way.
Yeah, and you know, my understanding is that there was so much shifting during COVID, so the idea is that this is supposed to be the new baseline. So they were ranked on achievement, which is a sort of test scores, growth, which is student improvement, target group outcomes, kind of how the lowest performing students do, and then what percentage of students are on track to graduate. And in theory, this idea is that it allows you to better see which schools provide opportunities for the students who need kind of the most support from schools. But as you say, there's this argument that, like, how are you supposed to compare schools year over year? And then also from some conservative critics, how are you supposed to compare districts if you have, you know, a much higher percentage of needy students who need more sort of interventions in the schools than, like, the wealthier districts? And so one conservative critic I spoke to said, essentially, this is just tracing where is the money in Wisconsin, and we already know that. So, again, this kind of ongoing thing from DPI. But it is, I guess, a change in the conversation about DPI in the last couple of weeks. At the federal level this week, a list of pardons came out late Sunday, so we're all on shutdown watch. And then here comes this list of pardons on social media about people tied to the false electors scheme of 2020, a list of both people who acted as false electors and then also a number of sort of architects of the plan, including two who are charged with being the Wisconsin-based architects who used Wisconsin as a testing ground. So that is Jim Troupas and Ken Chesbrough. They were all on this list of federal pardons. One thing to note is that nobody on the list, as were, I should mention, the 10 Wisconsin false electors, none of them are facing federal charges. And so this federal pardon doesn't actually have any legal significance. It is perhaps a symbol or a signal of the support that Trump has, you know, for these people who spread this myth that the election was stolen from him in 2020. Meanwhile, Chesbrough, Troupas, and then this other guy, Mike Roman, who is also on the list, they continue to face state investigation here in Wisconsin.
So I am not a lawyer, I often say, so I don't take my legal advice, but like you, I've been making calls, and it seems like this is symbolic, that you're not going to affect state charges. Though there are Trump loyalists who are trying to argue that this does have some kind of real meaning, that there is something going on here. Again, the 10 false electors, they already signed agreement to settle a civil lawsuit. That was done a year or two ago. Yeah, the three people are facing felony charges. The Department of Justice for Wisconsin said that case goes on. That's all they would say about these pardons. Ron Johnson, U.S. Senator, big Jim Troupas fan, cited the saying that it's time for Josh Call to drop his unjust persecution of Jim Troupas. That's not going to happen. But I'm wondering, Jeff Mandel is with Law Forward. It's this law firm, progressive law firm, that has been involved in this issue for a while. It's filed various complaints, including office of regulation complaints against Andrew Hitt, former state GOP chair, and Jim Troupas about their legal credentials. Arguing it's not just symbolic, it's sending a message that if you help Donald Trump in 2026 subvert the election, you're going to get a jail-free card. Now, that's a long ways away. We'll see. But is there more to this than just, hey, these guys should feel good, not going to face federal charges? We shall see.
And yeah, and you know, like, we have our sort of court situation here in Wisconsin. A number of other swing states that were also involved in this scheme have also been pursuing charges in their own way. And so those cases just continue to unfold. Mm-hmm. So again, it's that long tail, 6 years almost now since the 2020 election, and it kind of continues to dog our politics. We also, this week, it was the State of the Judiciary out of the Supreme Court. Jill Karofsky, Chief Justice, spoke, and we've spoken a little bit about sort of safety as it regards justices, and that was kind of the theme of the State of the Judiciary as well. So we will take a look at some video of that right now.
Every single person who walks into a courthouse deserves to be safe, and you deserve to be safe in your houses and in public places as well. Local sheriff's departments and law enforcement work hard to ensure justice is administered in safe environments. And statewide, we currently have one sergeant and three officers funded with state dollars dedicated to the entire court system. They assess security and they assess threats on a broader scope. Those four officers must coordinate with local agencies. We only have funding for those four positions through August of 2026, less than a year away, only about halfway through the biennium. I have been in conversations both with the governor's office and leaders in the legislature. And I will tell you that it is clear to me that safety in our court system is an issue that transcends partisan politics. And I believe our co-branches will do the right thing and invest the necessary funds to keep those four positions active through the end of the biennium and beyond.
So we've talked about this before, you know, this kind of push for more security at the Supreme Court. That was a little bit more of a forceful tone from Kurovsky than even at this luncheon. Mm-hmm. This was Politics Luncheon a couple of weeks ago. And it also comes as, in the shutdown deal, one of the components of it was much more money for security for federal judges. So an extra $30 million for U.S. Marshals and an extra $28 million for Supreme Court of the United States justices. And then meanwhile, there is this concern about these state and Supreme Court of Wisconsin judges and the security needs that they have.
Kurovsky also talked about the attacks in the judiciary that are political. Didn't name names, but you could kind of figure out who she's talking about, i.e. Donald Trump and his acolytes, that they are going after judiciary because of being unhappy with rulings, and this is attack on our democracy. Also thought it was interesting that Kurovsky tried to paint the court as a big, happy family. There are tensions among the justices that we see in their writing sometimes. If you're a astute observer of the Supreme Court, read the footnotes of the decisions. That's where the good stuff is sometimes. But anyway, she talked about how they Venmo together, that they hang out, they do things together, and that even though they disagree politically or legally, that they are still a cohesive unit. I'm not sure that everybody buys that, but still, she put a happy face in the court and that they're all working together to try and get things done for Wisconsin.
And of course, you know, like the election's going to start ramping up in the spring, maybe after the new year. And so we will also see kind of how well people are getting along when it's the heat of campaign season. Tons of legislative work going on these days. Both chambers are supposed to be in session next week. And so lots of committee action. In particular, we picked out some bills having to do with Knowles Nelson, elections, and education. So let's start by talking about Knowles Nelson. That is, of course, the state-run land purchase program for conservation purposes. That runs out of funding next summer. It wasn't included in the state budget, and so there are two GOP bills that would essentially re-up it through 2030. But that failed in committee, and I actually don't know that I have seen committee's deadlock, especially on something like this, which has been a little bit controversial, but does have bipartisan support typically. So what does that tell you?
They can still go to the floor. So even with a negative or a deadlock vote, it's okay. But it underscores there are some issues there. These two bills, one would kind of have most of the policy and some bonding. The other would have direct funding because Republicans have gotten smart with the governor's veto authority. Don't put money into a policy bill because the governor's going to rewrite the policy. So keep an eye on that one going forward.
That'll be really interesting. And then a number of elections bills, some of which we've been talking about, to set up hours to vote absentee, one that would require election observers to be given access to kind of every single aspect of the election process, one banning mobile or alternative sites to vote, and then a couple that are already slated to be on the floor next week, one that would make the Elections Commission have to investigate itself if there is a credible charge of a violation of the Help America Vote Act. The commission has previously said they can't investigate themselves, and one that would allow voters to automatically receive an absentee ballot for every election. Notably, not moving forward is the Monday processing bill.
Yes. Yeah, so Dave Maxey, the chair of that committee, sent me a statement on Monday saying we're not moving forward with, well, actually, the ban on drop boxes bill. We're not moving forward that one. Another one note, they heard that one in committee last week, so we're not moving forward that bill because there's a support for it. To get it out there. I personally like the idea. Conversation's not done. Lindy Brill, the co-author, was not very happy about that decision. But during this exact, the interesting thing was Scott Krug, a Republican from Rome, who's kind of taking the lead on most of the GOP election bills, pointed to that alternate site bill. So this gets at the Racine mobile vote, mobile van that took absentee ballots in, I think, just the primary for 2022, and then Democracy in the Park, which Madison had during COVID in 2020. Republican didn't care for that very much, and he said, look, if the governor would sign this bill as an act of good faith, I sure would push a lot, hell of a lot harder, in his words, for Monday processing. Lee Snodgrass went, okay, wait a second. We had this stuff in a compromise last session, and we were okay with some of it, but you took out Monday processing, which was the give and take, right? You give us this, Monday processing, we'll give you on some other things. Clint Anderson from Beloit also pushed back, saying, hey, because Krug was saying the governor's been radio silent on these things, won't work with them. Say, hey, you had a deal last session, and you turned your back on that deal. So now you're complaining about the... Anyway, it underscores the tensions here that Republicans want something done, but they can't figure out how to get Democrats on board because you have to have some kind of give on both sides. Everybody will tell you, Monday processing is the one thing that would resolve this kind of like late night conspiracy theory that of a vote dump at 2 a.m. out of Milwaukee and Green Bay. They can't agree on doing it though, And so how do you get around that issue? Worth noting, too, that the one bill that they passed that had all the other provisions that had money processing before, they took out a requirement that clerks would update people at, at 10 o'clock election night how they're doing processing ballots. Krug said, Paul Tittle, Republican, was like, well, how come that's out? And Krug said, that's a money processing provision. If you have Monday processing, come 10 o'clock election night, you should know where people are at. If you're not counted yet, what's going on? But without money processing, we're going to slow them down getting bills, votes counted until like the early morning hours.
Yeah, so very nitty-gritty. And again, this longstanding tale of the 2020 election really inspires so much of this legislation. Kind of the other package of bills that is moving forward are the GOP education bills. And so there's a number of them. They were introduced a couple of months ago, I want to say. There was a press conference about it, and then they were released a little bit more recently. Some of them were about school discipline and things like that, but then there were a lot about looking at school consolidation, and we have a little bit of video of that debate as well.
I have never had a single school district say, we don't want you to give us tools for if the time comes, we might need to use them. You heard from those two superintendents, and I think their testimony was a little twisted over there, but you heard them say that their primary motivation in doing that is to provide more opportunities for children. You act like schools don't want this. Yes, they do. Not all of them see the need right now, but they all are happy to have this, knowing going forward that if the time comes, they can use it.
We are voting on potential legislation that would provide potential tools that we do not know the effectiveness of, that we do not have clear guidance on what those outcomes from these tools could be after forcing districts to be in a position where they may have to consider consolidation. And there has not been any discussion on what these districts are supposed to do after potentially taking these courses and how the legislature may or may not support them in that process of potential consolidation.
Yeah, so what do you make of this debate? School consolidation has become a little bit of a pet GOP issue.
Well, we have incentives on the books already. They're trying to sweeten the pot with this. And also grade sharing, which is where, let's say you've got two neighboring districts. Let's say you've got a third grade that's really low for both districts. You put all the third graders in one school or one district versus the other. There are incentives, again, for consolidation, but they've been using them. So the question is kind of like, what would this be enough to sweeten the pot enough to get them to go? Also not seeing much of a Senate Republican embrace of these bills. If you notice what's been happening, you have Assembly Republicans proposing a lot of stuff, you have Democrats proposing a lot of stuff, and the Senate GOP kind of figuring out what do we want to do? And so the clock is really ticking, and the question is about the Senate GOP, what will they take that the Assembly GOP will do, and what the governor signed for the session ends.
Right, that's always kind of the question that hovers over it, is Governor Evers' education is obviously his, pet issue, near and dear to his heart, former state superintendent, and he has said many times he really believes in, local control and not kind of letting Madison weigh in on what school districts do. And so for questions like this that are so kind of infrastructural, always a question of whether he will sign off on. That brings us to the stock report, and rising this week we have the very sexy topic of wheel taxes.
Wisconsin Policy Forum did a report on wheel taxes. Believe it or not, these have been around since the 60s for munis and 70s for counties. Up until 2010, only four of them implemented them. We're now going to be at like 63 starting January 1st. The revenue from these jumped from like $10 million a decade or so ago to $70 million. So this is a response from locals to these state-imposed revenue limits. So they're trying to find alternative ways. Now, there's some issues with these things. One, if you don't raise them constantly, the buying power goes down, inflation goes up. And two, you have Democrats who are proposing, let's give local governments the power to raise the sales tax. You have Republicans saying, let's rein in wheel taxes. I'm kind of curious which message is better ahead of an election, because people are talking about affordability. So for Democrats, others saying, yes, we want to raise your taxes, or let locals raise your taxes, the best message going into November of next year.
Mixed is the Democratic gubernatorial field, which seems to only keep growing.
Yes. So now Joel Brennan, former administration secretary under Tony Evers, he's been a Milwaukee figure in various groups for a while. He's seriously considering it. And Mandela Barnes, who's been talking about it for a while, he's on the verge of getting in. The question is, like, when? It's not really if, it's when he's going to get in. So let's talk about Brennan first. the question becomes, what is your lane? We talk about that all the time in politics. What's his lane? Well, there's a Milwaukee person, David Crowley. There's a business person, Missy Hughes. There's a moderate in Sarah Rodriguez, maybe Missy Hughes too. It doesn't seem like, where does he fit? Now, you could argue, if you line them all up, he's unique because he's a white male, which I know is kind of odd to say in politics, but it's true. He's the only white male that's looking about running. White males have done well in Democratic primaries before. Tony Evers in 2018, Tom Barrett in 2012 in the recall election, Jim Doyle in 2002. All of them were not the most liberal candidate in the primary field, but they all had name ID. Tony Evers, statewide elected official. I think he won three times when he ran. Tom Barrett ran for governor in 2010, didn't win, fed off a challenge from Kathleen Falk in 2012 in that recall primary. 2002, Jim Doyle been AG, attorney general for three terms. Like, they had built up this base of name ID. For Brennan, how do you get there? So if you're going to grab a lane, whatever lane it's going to be, you have to be known. How much money do you have to spend to get there? Go back to 2022, that Senate primary, when Matt Dale Barnes was in it with Alec Lazary and Sarah Galuski and Tom Nelson. Alec Lazary spent millions of dollars to get his name ID up and couldn't overtake Mandela Barnes. So there's Brennan's issue. How's he get known and what's his lane going to be? For Mandela, it's okay. You're still this divisive figure where people, like, again, it's like this political Rorschach test. He lost by 23,000 votes or so, 27,000, to an incumbent senator. Got outspent in that race. But he's unelectable? Like, how does that make sense? But then people go, well, yeah, because he has A, B, and C in his background. He had his shot. He didn't pull it off. Ron Johnson's very unpopular. If you look at his favorable, unfavorable Marquette poll, never a very popular figure. So he had his chance. He shouldn't come back. Well, Mandela looks like he's going to come back. So then what? How does that shape this race? And it continues to be a question of, once he gets in, we assume he has the best name ID of anybody in the field. Can anybody overtake that? Usually you do that by spending money and tearing a guy down. Can they tear him down, and can they match money? Because Mandela, we think, can raise money again because of what he raised in 2022.
And that takes us to falling. We've talked a little bit about these Knowles Nelson bills. Falling this week is stewardship.
So the perception has been for a while the problems in the Senate. So Tony Kurtz in the Assembly and Pat Tustin in the Senate, Republicans, are the advocates for this program on the GOP side. They are somewhat lonely voices in these two houses. The Senate's been the problem, where we see Mary Felskowski from up north saying they got too much property as it is. She's from a Senate district that has a whole lot of land protected either by stewardship, federal forest, state forest, county, on down the line. If the more you protect, which is good for outdoor recreation and enjoyment, less you have to develop, which is not great for local tax base. So there's that issue. This vote in the Assembly now shows you, in the committee, there's an issue in the Assembly as well, that there are people going, wait a second. I talked to both Rob Swearingen and Calvin Callahan after the committee votes on Wednesday this week. They showed me handouts they had that show how many acres in their districts are in the stewardship program as we speak. In Swearingen's, it's 66,000 acres, I think. It's a lot of land. And he's saying, look, Rob made clear, you maybe can get me before the vote on the floor, maybe in January, but there's work to do. That's going to be the challenge. How do Kurtz and Tustin get people on board? Oh, by the way, Democrats aren't happy because it's going far enough. They want more money. They say we should have more of an investment, that they're shortchanging the program, and they're going, on the one hand, we could help you guys pass this bill. Of course, there's this rule of 50 and 17. So in the Assembly, you want 50 Republican votes for anything you're going to do. In the Senate, you want 17 GOP votes from the minority. So if you were going to break that rule, we could help you. But what's our incentive to help you? Because if we help you, it's called the one kick of the cat rule in the Capitol. If you're going to change a big program, you get one shot at it. They don't go back and rejigger something like a year later. So they know, Democrats, if you were to pass a stewardship bill that has not enough in their minds, that's it. They're not getting another shot unless they had full control of everything and do it on their own way after 2026.
Yeah, so Knowles Nelson named for a bipartisan mix of Republican and Democratic governors, but it's still very subject to this kind of political debate, as mm-hmm. per usual. And that'll do it for us at Rewind. I am Aniven Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And we'll see you next week. Mm-hmm.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association. bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.